Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The history of a place is far more complicated than the people who live there would like to believe. John Biewen is the director of audio at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. John grew up in Mankato, Minnesota, and he says nobody there ever talked about the most important historical event ever to happen. In 1862, it was the site of the largest mass execution in U.S. history. 38 Dakota men were hanged after battles with white settlers. The story, Little War on the Prairie, is featured on this week's This American Life, which airs at 11 a.m. Central, 10 a.m. Mountain on Saturday, and again on Sunday night, 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB Radio. John Biewen joins us on the phone now. John, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about where you came to this story. When did you sort of learn, because you didn't learn it in elementary school, middle school, or high school, when did you learn
That's right.
Mankato was this place where something so significant had happened?
Well, there were some things. It's one of those things, it's hard to remember exactly when I first heard about it in any substantial way, but there were some things. There was I think it was the St. Paul paper did a series in the late 80s, and then there was a public television, Minnesota public TV program in the 90s that told the story in ways that that were certainly more substantial than anything that I had heard before. So it wasn't really so much, a secret, but in a way, my point was, yes, that it was for something of that significance to have happened, not only, in your state, but literally in your town. And the fact that it just was never even kind of part of the everyday conversation, the fact that I didn't learn it in school, that seemed odd to me.
Right. You're hanging out at the mall and, you're living life and not realizing that very close to this spot, there's a history that's unknown to you.
Yeah, exactly. And that it was really a very important and of course, you highlight the hanging, which is appropriate, largest mass execution in U.S. history. But that was kind of the culmination or one of the kind of the last results of what was a pretty significant Plains Indian War, which really, given the scale of it and the death toll and so on, really should be part of our history alongside things like the Wounded Knee Massacre and the Battle of Little Bighorn. I mean, it's really of that kind of scale, but it was, and I think a big part of the reason that the U.S. Dakota War was overlooked in the larger sense is that it happened during the Civil War. So it just got, excuse me, I'm having trouble with my voice here, but it just got completely overshadowed by that much bigger event, even in terms of kind of registering the way that it should have in our history.
Yeah, you're sort of a really important to radio. So, as a general rule, we want your voice to be okay. So you just let me know. But I want to talk a little bit about one of the people that you featured in this audio documentary, which we'll hear on This American Life, and it's Gwen Westerman, because she doesn't know the history either, but she has this very physical reaction to sort of being in this space. Tell me a little bit about her story.
Yeah, that's a remarkable story that, excuse me, I've got to work through this. I've got to warm it up here. Gwen is a Dakota, member of the Dakota tribe, but she was really part of what you could call the diaspora. The Dakota people were basically expelled from the state of Minnesota with the approval of President Lincoln after the U.S. Dakota War. At the end of 1862, and of course, a number of those people would have gone to South Dakota and other places. Gwen grew up in I think Kansas, I believe, if I remember right, and never heard about this history, but then found herself taking a job as a professor at Minnesota State Mankato, and one of her relatives said to her, that's a special place. There are deep ties to that place, but interestingly, didn't tell her what that was, what he was referring to, and he knew about the hangings and the war, but she didn't. And then she went there, and she tells this story in the documentary of having a going down for an event. All she knew, a friend of hers said, "Oh, there's some kind of event involving American Indian people. Let's go see what it is." And it was the annual small event then, what was then a small event, gathering of Dakota people to mark the anniversary on the day after Christmas every year, the anniversary of the mass hanging. And they went down there, and they didn't even know what the event was. And she described having this very powerful physical and emotional reaction just to being in that spot on that day. Right. So it's a very interesting kind of spiritual, mystical story that she tells. And we chuckle about it a little bit because I say, come on, that's a little too good to be true. But she swears it happened. That was back in the 90s. And she's now been in Mankato ever since teaching and has learned in great detail about those events. And she's one of my main guides in telling the story.
I don't know if you know the poet Layli Long Soldier, but she has a poem called 38 where she writes about the hanging and the events that led up to it. And she talks about monuments to the white settlers who were killed. And right. She talks about the monument to, and I'm misquoting her right now because I don't have the poem in front of me, but the memorial is an action, not a monument, in the sense that every year there's this moment where there's a homecoming. It's a, you know, we cross the border, we return home, and that is the poem of these people. So I apologize to Layli for sort of misquoting her poem there, but you should find that poem called 38 on your own and read through it. It's quite powerful. But I bring this up because I want to talk to you about this sort of monument that you find to this spot where some white settlers were killed. And there's various stories about what all led up to it. But tie that small sort of, you know, it's in somebody's yard kind of monument.
Yes.
With some of the ways that this story is told in the schools and as people try to get their arms around how to explain this
from
a historic perspective.
To the extent that going back further, and I think about my younger life, even when I first started hearing references to it, maybe say when I was a young adult, and I stayed in the area. I went to college at Gustavus Adolphus College, which is 12 miles away in St. Peter, Minnesota. It's really very much in the same area. You would hear it referred to as the Sioux Uprising,
right.
And there were books written that would, you know, referred to it in that way. And that kind of framing of the events of 1862 sort of make it sound as if, you know, these savage Indians kind of went crazy one day and started killing people. And it leaves out all of the background that led up to that happening, which were broken treaties, people being the Dakota people having been basically shoved into small reservations and then not given the the things that were promised to them, the food and the money and gold that was promised to them so that they could actually live on that small reservation. And so people were literally starving in the summer of 1862. And there was an incident on a farm in Acton, Minnesota, which is in central Minnesota, in which, and there are differing stories about how it actually happened, but some young Dakota men killed five white settlers. And that sort of sparked then the decision, actually by the Dakota, by a kind of branch or kind of more militant young men, young warriors, to say, all right, they're going to come down on us because of this incident. So let's just go to war ourselves and try to drive these people out, drive these settlers out of here. And that started the events in August of 1862.
And
there's this little monument that's
right.
Literally in someone's backyard, the backyard of a farm tucked away in central Minnesota. The monument was put up in the 1960s, and it tells a very incomplete story of what happened. So, that's part of the piece, Gwen Westerman and I going to see that.
You mentioned broken treaties. Let's expand on this this entire, you know, history here, because we have Thomas Jefferson, and you travel to a museum in the documentary And it's not just that a treaty was signed and then it was broken. It's that there was this sort of plan of saying, how are we going to get a hold of this land? And Thomas Jefferson and others say, well, the best way to do that is to put people into debt. And when they're in debt, then we'll take the land. The treaties are mistranslated so that the Dakota people don't have the full picture of what they're signing as far as when they're going to get the money that they're agreeing to. There's another piece of paper at the end of the first treaty that the Dakota warriors sort of, or you know, the people who are representing the tribe.
Dakota chiefs, yeah.
So, thank you. Dakota chiefs sort of think is something else, but it has something to do with all that money that they're really getting going to pay off their debt. It is a web
yes.
of intentional lies and deceit in order to specifically get people's land and eliminate them.
Yes, and that series of deceits starts with the long-running economy of trapping and trading and so on that led and that's basically an economy run by white traders, and they are the ones keeping the books, and a lot of the actual hunting and trapping is being done by Native American men, right? And they have these kind of relationships with the traders, and so they'll bring in, you know, pelts and so on, and be given things in return, and also some money and so on. And the traders at some point start to say, okay, well, you are deeply in debt to me. And all of the Dakota men owe us X many thousands of dollars. And there's no real way of knowing for sure now whether those figures were accurate at all.
Right.
And people speculate about it, right? But the point is that it's a power dynamic where the white traders were the ones keeping the books, and they said, well, you owe us tens of thousands of dollars, and so some of these treaties were signed with the understanding there was a sense that the whole tribe was in debt, and well, if we we cut a deal to turn over vast areas of our land. In return for some amount of money, but actually a big chunk of that is going to go to just taking care of our debts. So there was a great deal of kind of leverage applied. And we also there's also a quote of an official in Minnesota, Luke Lee, who said during those negotiations, as I put it, you know, he didn't need to say it, but he did anyway. Which is that we could come with 100,000 soldiers and drive you off to the Rocky Mountains. So there's an explicit threat there as well, that you kind of, you know, sign this treaty and give up your land or else. And then, yes, after all that, this treaty is signed. And then even that treaty, which has, you know, this leverage has been used to give the Native Americans not a very good deal for their land, then that treaty is broken anyway, and their land is taken, half their land is taken back, and half the land given up for the reservation is taken back, and the food and gold is not delivered as promised.
And the
people
starve.
not a pretty picture.
I want to talk about how, since this this American Life, this audio documentary first came out, you can tell as you listen to it that it affects you personally as you walk through and do the work and hand the microphone over, to others and sort of listen to the stories. And now, how do you feel about it with a little bit further looking back and having had people give their responses as well?
Yeah, the response has been very strong. This first came out in 2012, which was the 150th anniversary. Excuse me, of the war and of the hangings. And maybe I'll take this slight opportunity to plug my podcast, because I reincorporated that piece into a 14-part podcast series that I did. My podcast that we do here at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke is called Seen on Radio, S-C-E-N-E. And I did a 14-part series called Seeing White, which kind of looks at race in America in a historic, pretty deep historic sense. And looks at it, kind of turns the lens around and looks at it through the history of whiteness and of white supremacy, and puts that story in that context along with other aspects of American history that we told. And yeah, I think there's a real reckoning that we still need to have in this country about, you know, I think most people recognize that there's a painful history of racism and of racial exploitation and oppression. But we tend to think of it as sort of a blemish on what is, for the most part, a really kind of wonderful, glorious story of a great country. And I think that most white people still have a deeper reckoning to have. And it's not to say that, you know, we should all hang our heads in shame, or we should all go back to Europe, or, you know, that we're terrible people. And it's not about that, but it's about a more honest understanding of really of how we got where we are, that I think this story is a significant part of.
And which also changes where we might go then and who we might become.
Well, I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think it the way that we should be thinking about these relationships now in places like Minnesota and South Dakota with the native people who were there long before we European Americans came. And, you know, and as we look at the situation now and those relationships, I think we would be having somewhat different conversations about how we work things out among ourselves if more influential people in power, mostly, of course, white people, really, really come to terms with the history.